Well, here we go with today's reading of the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, September 16th, 2025. And with today's Wall Street Journal, we say hello and good morning to Mary.
Good morning. And the first story up on the Wall Street Journal is Trump decries rule on quarterly profits. President Trump said companies should no longer be required to report their earnings on a quarterly basis, an idea he explored during his first term that has gained traction recently. Publicly traded companies in the U.S. have reported results every 3 months for the past 50-plus years. Instead, Trump argued companies should report their earnings every 6 months. This will save money and allow managers to focus on properly running their companies, Trump wrote on Truth Social on Monday. His proposal echoes one from the long-term stock exchange, which said last week it plans to petition the Securities and Exchange Commission to eliminate the quarterly reporting requirements. LTSE instead proposed giving companies the option to share results twice a year. Current SEC leadership has signaled an interest in reducing regulation, and LTSE represents were encouraged following a recent meeting with the SEC officials about their planned proposal, the Wall Street Journal reported last week. The move is likely to face the opposition from investors who rely on the transparency of regular disclosure and crave more. Quarterly earnings reports typically go hand in hand with earnings calls that allow analysts to ask questions of company executives. One of the reasons I invest in public companies instead of private companies more often is because you get that information, said James McRitchie, an individual investor in about 350 companies. Timelessness is important. Any change would take a while to come to fruition. The SEC typically publishes proposal it receives and requests public comments. LTSE is a stock trading venue for companies focused on long-term goals. Its proposal would apply to all U.S. public companies, not just the few listed on its exchange. Advocates of doing away with quarterly reporting requirements believe such a change could revive the shrinking number of public companies in the U.S. Would-be public companies often cite the time-consuming and costly clerical work required to list and maintain publicly traded shares as a major factor in decisions to stay private or sell them instead. Publicly listed companies in Europe are no longer required to report earnings on a quarterly basis following a 2013 rule change, but many still choose to do so. The UK also ended quarterly reporting requirements about a decade ago, yet many companies continue to report. The number of publicly traded companies in the US is about 3,700 as of late June, down about 17% from 3 years ago, according to the Center for Research in Security Prices. That number has roughly halved since its peak in 1997. Trump, a Republican, explored ending quarterly earning reports during his first term, saying at the time that he had spoken to top business leaders and arguing it would allow for more long-term planning. In 2018, he asked regulators to study such a change, but the effort went nowhere. That same year, J.P. Morgan Chase chief executive Jamie Dimon and legendary investor Warren Buffett co-wrote an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal, supporting the idea to move away from reporting quarterly earnings estimates, though made clear they weren't opposing quarterly reporting itself. The pair argued that companies hold back on spending and hiring to meet quarterly earning forecasts. Publicly traded corporations have been required to submit quarterly earnings reports since 1970. Musk's 1 billion buy fuels Tesla's stock leap. Shares in Tesla jumped, jumped Monday after Elon Musk brought about 1 billion worth of the company's stock, signaling his confidence in the electric car maker. Tesla's chief executive purchased more than 2.5 million shares in the company via a trust Friday, according to a regulatory filing released Monday. It was his first stock purchase in the open market since February 2020. TSLA up $69 to $420 as foretold in the prophecy. Musk wrote on X on Monday following the disclosure, making a reference to sex and drug culture. The change in share price was shown in a one-week stock chart. The move expresses Musk's commitment to the company as the board prepares for a shareholder vote on a lucrative new pay package that could deliver as much as $1 trillion in stock to him over the next decade. To us, this sends a strong signal of confidence in the most important part of Tesla's future business. Robotaxi, Jed Dorsheimer, an analyst with William Blair, wrote, in the quarterly earnings. The newfound flexibility. Just got to go back to the other page. All right. And Beijing regulator says NVIDIA violated antitrust regulations. Regulators' move against chip giant comes during latest trade talks with the U.S. China said, China said an initial probe found NVIDIA violated the country's anti-monopoly law, heightening pressure on Washington during the latest round of U.S.-China trade talks that ended on Monday. Beijing's antitrust regulators cited the violations in connection with NVIDIA's acquisition of an Israeli company that was completed in 2020. The regulators said the investigation was continuing and it didn't elaborate on the preliminary findings or say whether it would punish NVIDIA. Beijing approved the deal after NVIDIA agreed to conditions, including guaranteeing the supply of its chips to China. Since 2022, the U.S. government has blocked NVIDIA and other U.S. chip vendors from selling many of their top-flight artificial intelligence chips to China. NVIDIA said it complied with the Chinese law. We will continue to cooperate with all relevant government agencies as they evaluate the impact of export controls on competition, a company representative said. Beijing's move came hours before Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said in Madrid that the U.S. and Chinese negotiators had reached a framework deal on TikTok following 2 days of trade talks. The two sides were running up against a Wednesday deadline to complete a deal to allow the popular video sharing app to continue operating in the U.S. NVIDIA's shares were little changed in Monday trading. NVIDIA has become perhaps the highest profile business caught in the crossfire of the trade dispute between the two world's two biggest economies. The company sells the world's most powerful chips, which are essential for building state-of-the-art AI. In December, China's antitrust regulator, the State Administration for Market Regulation, opened a probe into NVIDIA's $7 billion acquisition of the Israeli networking gear maker, Mellanox Technologies. A week earlier, the Biden administration ratcheted up controls on China's access to high-end chips. Antitrust lawyers familiar with the case said NVIDIA was in a tough spot because it had to halt supply of its most advanced chips to China to comply with U.S. export controls. But that opened up to a criticalism from Beijing. Chinese regulators argued that NVIDIA was violating its pledge back in 2020 to provide an uninterrupted supply of chips to China and to treat Chinese customers equally, the lawyers said. In July, President Trump, a Republican, permitted NVIDIA to resume sales of its H20 chip, which is useful for AI interference. The chip was popular in China before Trump temporarily blocked its sale in April. Shortly after Trump gave the green light, Beijing raised concerns about potential cybersecurity risks of the chip and stopped companies from buying it until NVIDIA could clear a regulatory review. NVIDIA has said its products don't have remote trackers or other backdoors. The company and its customers in China are now hoping the Trump administration will approve an NVIDIA AI chip that is more advanced than the H20. Another subject that is likely to end up on the bargaining table at the trade talks. China hasn't been able to produce at scale any chips as powerful as NVIDIA's best products, partly owing to U.S. restrictions on advanced chip-making equipment. Still, Chinese companies are making progress in substituting their own products for U.S. chips. By flaunting possible punishment of NVIDIA over an antitrust issue, China wanted to show it wasn't about to make concessions to get the U.S. company's products and was on the road to self-sufficiency in AI, said Feng Chuqing, founding partner of Beijing advisory firm Hongtong Research. Beijing likely was signaling that NVIDIA is not a bargaining chip for the U.S., he said. National champion Huawei has been powering some of the country's AI data centers with self-developed chips. Other tech giants such as Alibaba and Baidu have also increased the use of homegrown products in their own infrastructure. China has been funding its domestic chip industry more aggressively since Trump's first term with the goal of long-term self-sufficiency. At the same time, Beijing has tried to secure access to the latest technology of the U.S. and its allies for now to keep Chinese companies competitive in the tech race. And the Senate confirms Myron for the Fed's board. Officials plan to stay at White House job on unpaid leave while at the central bank. President Trump notched a swift victory Monday night when the Senate confirmed his senior economic advisor to join the Federal Reserve Board just hours before officials gather to consider cutting interest rates at a two-day meeting that starts Tuesday. The Republican-controlled Senate approved Stephen Miron's appointment largely along party lines. On a 48-47 vote, just 2 weeks after receiving his nomination from the White House, making it the second fastest Fed confirmation in more than a quarter century. Myron will fill the seat that Adriana Kugler unexpectedly stepped down from last month. It is a notable achievement for the White House because Myron, who in March was confirmed as chairman of Trump's Council of Economic Advisers, indicated he wouldn't resign that position. He will be the first executive branch official to sit on the central bank's board since a landmark overhaul of the Fed's governance in 1935. Myron has said he plans to take an unpaid leave from the CEA to fill the remainder of a Fed board term that runs through January, so that he can return to the White House next year if he isn't nominated to a different central bank seat. Myron told lawmakers at his confirmation hearing this month he would act independently in the job. Myron's participation in the Fed meeting isn't likely to change the outcome, but he will be able to submit an economic projection that can influence market expectations of the near-term policy path. Some analysts think he is likely to dissent in favor of a larger rate cut. Trump is separately attempting to remove Fed Governor Lisa Cook from her seat. Late Monday, Cook prevailed in a one step of her legal fight against Trump when a federal appeals court rejected an emergency request by the administration to remove Cook ahead of this week's meeting. Former economic policymakers from both parties and Fed veterans have said Myron's dual-hatted arrangement could chip away at the public's confidence that the central bank operates free of direct influence from the executive branch. It was a very bad signal not to resign the position in the administration, said Eric Rosengren, who served as the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, federal from 2007 until 2021. It's very puzzling unless you want to show in a definite way that you didn't care about being perceived as independent. Greg Mankiewicz, a Harvard economist who headed the CEA under former President George W. Bush, said the arrangement would be akin to the Attorney General taking a temporary leave to serve as a justice on the Supreme Court. I see it as part of the overall Trump strategy of bringing monetary policy more under the White House control, he said. The only Republican who voted against Myron's confirmation, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. She said, and Myron had a good conversation over the weekend, but that his unwillingness to resign his White House job raised her concern about compromising the Fed's independence. It's all about appearances, she told reporters Monday night. Myron has previously been sharply critical of Fed officials who move into executive branch jobs and vice versa. In a social media post 2 years ago, he said it was impossible to think someone can go from highly political operative to politically neutral just because he or she gets a promotion. That's just not how human beings work. Myron, who has a PhD in economics from Harvard, worked in the asset management industry and did a stint as an advisor to the Treasury Department in Trump's first term. Myron has been highly critical of the Fed policy under Chair Jerome Powell, including the central bank's decision to lower interest rates last year and its cautious approach to further cuts after tariffs raised new concerns about inflation risks. Trump has called for the Fed to lower rates aggressively, and Myron has said Trump's policy instincts have consistently proved to be a more clairvoyant than Powell's. And the appeals court rejects President's bid to fire Cook. The Federal Appeals Court on Monday night rejected an emergency Trump administration request to remove Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook. ahead of the central bank's next meeting. A divided three-judge panel in Washington, D.C. left in place a lower court injunction that blocked Cook's termination while she challenges the legality of President Trump's move. The administration could seek intervention from the Supreme Court, but it is running out of time before the next Fed meeting, which begins Tuesday. Trump announced last month that he would remove Cook, citing allegations that she submitted fraudulent information on mortgage applications before she took office. Federal Housing Finance Agency Director Bill Pult, a Trump appointee, first publicized the allegations and referred them to the Justice Department, which has since launched a criminal investigation. Cook hasn't been charged with a crime and in court filings has denied committing mortgage fraud. In her most recent submission, her lawyers say that the complete property records reveal the opposite of what the administration claims. Cook sued soon after Trump's announcement, triggering a high-stakes battle over the president's authority to control the central bank. She says Trump violated the Federal Reserve Act because he didn't provide a valid basis for her removal. The statute provides that the president can only remove a member of the Fed board for cause. Cook's lawyers say unproven allegations unrelated to the job performance don't meet that standard, and they suggested that Trump is targeting her because she has disagreed with him on the wisdom of lowering interest rates. U.S. District Judge Jacob ruled last week that Cook was substantially likely to succeed with a claim that her firing was unlawful and blocked her removal for now. Cook's lawyers said that pausing that court order would threaten her ability to participate in the coming federal meeting, as well as her seat on the board in the long term, noting Trump has signaled he would move quickly to replace her. Any sign that the Fed's independence is in jeopardy risks unsettling markets, particularly following Trump's months-long public pressure on the Fed chair Jerome Powell to lower interest rates, they added. This moment calls for orderly process and sober deliberation, not a destabilizing rush to judgment, they said. Judge Gregory Katsas, a Trump appointee, dissented. The Fed, no doubt, is important, but that only heightens the government's interest in ensuring that its governors are competent and capable of projecting confidence into markets, he wrote. If Fed's governors were entitled to a hearing before removal, the adequacy of that process would be challenged and take months or years to resolve, Katsas wrote. And that would enable a potentially compromised governor to engage in significant governmental action, such as voting on whether to adjust interest rates, which Cook says she must do tomorrow, he added. The Trump administration argues the president has a broad discretion to decide what constitutes a valid justification for removing a Fed official. The Supreme Court has already allowed the Trump administration to remove members of other independent federal agencies, but suggested in one ruling that Fed employees may have more protection because the agency is a uniquely structured quasi-private entity. The Fed is widely expected to cut interest rates at its next meeting. The Senate on Monday night voted to confirm Stephen Miron, Trump's pick to fill a vacancy on the Fed board so that he can attend this week's meeting. and terrorists pinch New Jersey's Little India. When the dancers and the drummers and the parade flotillas rolled through this stretch of central New Jersey in early August, ahead of India Day, it was as much a celebration of the community's vibrancy and success as it was an occasion to mark the country's independence. Less than a month later, after President Trump's 50% tariffs on Indian imports took effect, the mood of Indian businesses along the thoroughfare known as Oak Tree Road has turned notably downbeat. Many of the more than 200 businesses say they are wrestling with how to deal with tariffs, and some wonder whether they'll be able to last. The economy here is plateauing or even going down, says Mahesh Shah, vice chairman of the local Indian Business Association, which hosted the annual parade. Smaller businesses may not survive. Companies across the U.S. have wrestled for months with how best to handle Trump's tariffs on global imports, navigating tricky questions like whether to eat the cost themselves or raise prices, and risk losing customers. Meanwhile, the tariff landscape remains mired in uncertainty. A federal appeals court last month struck down many of the duties, saying Trump lacked the legal authority to impose them in the first place. However, the tariffs remain in place while the case proceeds through the courts. Few business communities have come under the strain of tariffs as much as Oak Tree Road. The strip of suburbia that lies between the towns of Edison and Woodbridge was 40 years ago largely run down and desolate. In the 1980s, Indian immigrants started arriving from New York City and elsewhere to open small Indian restaurants and shops on the Woodbridge side. Over time, the number of businesses grew, and the area drew higher-end brands like Malabar Gold and Diamond Soon, South Asian families across the eastern seaboard were driving to Little India on weekends to dine, stock up on imported Indian groceries, and shop for saris, gold jewelry, and traditional wedding attire. Many of the Oak Tree's business owners have raised families in Edison, where 46% of the population is estimated to be of Indian ancestry. A single family home now sells for a median of more than $600,000, having risen 80% in the past decade. Last month, a day after levies doubled to 50%, Edison Mayor Sam Joshi hosted Mikey Sorrell, the Democrat U.S. representative running for New Jersey governor, for a lunch at the local Mogul Express restaurant. Business owners approached her with a tale of woe about over tariffs. "Our products are artisanal and can't be made anywhere else," said Shashank Gupta, whose family owns Nazarana, one of the largest retailers of ethnic Indian garments in the U.S. A Shawani, the long coat worn by an Indian groom that was priced around $2,500 before tariffs, now runs upward of $3,100. Aqib Varani, who helps his father run an Indian jewelry shop and also was at the luncheon with Cheryl, says tariffs have been especially painful for jewelers like theirs that sell by weight on top of record high gold prices. Varani wishes he had front-loaded before the full 50% came online. Now he plans to wait a few months before deciding whether to import from India again. "We told all our vendors to keep orders on hold," said Varani. "We couldn't afford it." Trump's escalation of tariffs on India surprised businesses here. Some of them read India Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to the White House in February as a signal of good relations between the two countries. Many thought there would be a trade deal to move duties lower. More Indian Americans in the U.S. support the Democrat Party than the Republicans, although the share willing to back Trump has increased since the 2016 election, according to surveys by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Along Oak Tree Road, some business owners voted for Trump on the expectation that his policies would be better for local economy. A lot of the diaspora will rethink who they vote for next time, says Gupta, the garment retailer. His father, who voted for Trump, isn't happy about the outcome. He's a bit more stressed than I am, said the son. Kamal Arora, owner of Mogul Group, which includes a wedding catering business, restaurants, and a traditional dessert shop, says almost all his ingredients and products are imported from India. This includes foods like specialty Indian wheat flour or naan, ground spices, and frozen bricks of paneer cheese, as well as metal serving platters and clay cups for chai tea. Arora raised prices right after COVID and hasn't increased them again for fear of losing customers. He says in his monitoring news on the U.S.-India trade talks day by day, and if the 50% tariff stays, he may raise menu prices by 10% to 15%. Raj Patel and his father Kashik Patel run two stores on Oak Tree that are part of a large family supermarket chain. They are trying to maintain their margins. With a magnifying glass each month, they go over their invoices line by line. When the cost of a 40-pound bag of zebra basmati rice went to $60 from $50, for example, they increased the shelf price to $69.99 from $59.99. Other times, they absorb some of the cost, such as with the 5% to 10% increase on Vidal frozen curry. The younger Patel said they raised their prices by just 5% because the curries are a customer favorite. Shah from the Indian Business Association says he isn't worried about the community staying afloat. Given the size of the South Asian diaspora, people are still going to get married, he said, adding that their parties last for days. And hurdles for a next commissioner. Trump has nominated E.J. Antoni, chief economist at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, and a Trump supporter of and critic of the BLS as the Bureau's next commissioner. He will prioritize increasing survey response rates and modernizing data collection methods, White House spokeswoman Taylor Rogers said. There are other hurdles to improving data quality, such as resources. Adjusted for inflation, the BLS's budget has shrunk 13% since 2016. Trump has requested an 8% reduction in the BLS's budget and headcount for the coming fiscal year. In March, he disbanded a pair of unpaid expert committees that advised the agency on how to optimize its process. And survey fatigue rears its head in economic data. Anyone who surveys the public From marketeers to pollsters, struggles nowadays to get people to answer their questions. That phenomenon afflicts crucial government data, making it harder for policymakers and investors to know the true state of the economy. Falling survey participation is an important reason. The flagship jobs report released every month by the Bureau of Labor Statistics has undergone such a big revisions recently. This has rippled into the political sphere. On August 1st, President Trump fired BLS Commissioner Erica McIntyre after a particularly large downward revision to jobs for May and June that owed partly to late responses from survey participants. The White House and top administration officials increased their attacks on the BLS last week, after the agency published an annual revision suggesting the U.S. added 911,000 fewer jobs over the 12 months through March. The BLS blamed the initial overestimate partly on response rates. Trump said numbers were rigged to hurt him. In fact, current and former BLS officials attribute the revisions to a decline in participants responding on time or at all. The problem is due to a variety of factors, few easily reversed. One hypothesis is known as survey fatigue. People are being asked to answer too many questionnaires. Jonathan Eggleston, a senior economist at the U.S. Census Bureau, found in a 2024 study that recent participants in that agency's monthly and annual surveys, which are voluntary, were less likely to answer the 2020 census by mail, phone, or online without a knock on the door. Another is the rise of cell phones with caller ID. In the days of landlines, people had to pick up the phone to know who was calling. These days, many decline to answer callers they don't recognize. The government's monthly jobs report is based on two surveys, one of households and one of establishments. For the household survey, the BLS uses the calculate the unemployment rate and other demographic data, the U.S. Census Bureau contacts a rotating sample of 60,000 households by phone or in person. From January 1994 to November 2012, the response rate didn't fall below 90%. Since 2023, it has hovered at or below 70%. The margin of error for the unemployment rate has thus drifted upward. In January of 2018, the BLS considered a 0.17 percentage point change in the jobless rate to be statistically significant. By August, it was 0.21 percentage point. The establishment survey, which yields data on payrolls, earnings, and hours, covers about 121,000 businesses and government agencies representing 631,000 establishments, that is, work sites, and a quarter of all non-farm workers. Establishments that agree to participate can do so in several ways. Smaller companies often answer BLS surveyor questions by phone. Others report through a website after an emailed reminder. The largest, with 50 or more establishments, can report via electronic data interchange. BLS seeks to recruit about 70,000 new establishments each year. Since mid-2015, the share that agreed to participate has fallen 35% from 78%. The share of survey participants that responded in time for the jobs report each month has fallen from an average of 74% from 2010 to 2019 to 57% in August. Many respond by the second or third month, leading to large and growing revisions. From 2010 to 2019, the gap between the first and the third BLS estimate of non-farm payrolls for a particular month averaged at 35,000. Since 2023, it has averaged 60,000. Wild swings in the economy during and after COVID-19 pandemic have made it harder to adjust for seasonal factors, and the BLS can only make educated guesses on how many new establishments are formed or closed down each month. The shift to remote work during the pandemic made it harder to reach some establishments by accelerating the extension of office landlines. Bill Beach, whom Trump appointed BLS commissioner during his first term and continued to serve during Joe Biden's presidency, said, "We've tried everything, including adopting web-based and electronic response systems." Eric Goshen, who served as BLS commissioner during Barack Obama's second term, said, "Businesses contacted by government surveyors increasingly ask their lawyers whether to answer. That's usually considered the kiss of death," Goshen said. "All lawyers want to do is minimize work and risk." Let's see. And polls fear war closing in after Russian drone attack. Moments before the top of her house was ripped off Wednesday morning, Ala Wesolowski had gone downstairs to make breakfast. Hearing the crash, she raced outside to see a warplane roaring across the dawn sky. "Right above my head, flying so low, it was so loud," Wesolowski said as she picked through the rubble. She and her family, who lived less than 20 miles from the Ukrainian border, found themselves caught in the crossfire of an unprecedented encounter between Russian drones and NATO jet fighters, the latest escalation in the confrontation between Moscow and the West. There were no injuries from the all-night incursion, but days later, residents in Poland's eastern edges are fearful for their future. Many worry that the recent incursion was a prelude and that the violence that has raged for more than 3 years in neighboring Ukraine might more powerfully burst over the border. On her soy and corn farm in eastern Poland, Katarzyna Dwigala said she heard a thud as she was getting her children ready for school. Wednesday, when teachers cancelled classes, she found out the noise had been caused by a drone. NATO shot at least 3 of 19 drones out of the sky, targeting the ones that posed a direct threat, said Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, who told lawmakers that the incident brought the country closer to conflict than at any time since World War II. "My son asked me yesterday if the war was coming," Dwigala said. The 38-year-old tried to reassure him, but acknowledges having had similar thoughts. The family lives about a 40-minute drive from the Ukrainian border. The incursion has opened a new chapter in Poland's experience of the Ukraine war. The country has been the target of Russian sabotage meant to undermine Warsaw's support for Kiev. Moscow has carried out a campaign of hybrid warfare in which it is suspected of having set fires at factories, shopping centers, and warehouses. The drone incursion, however, pushes its operations closer to military confrontation. "The kids are really scared," Dwigala said. The government has pledged to enhance security together with its North Atlantic Treaty Organization allies, who have donated helicopters and jet fighters to strengthen the alliance's eastern border. On Saturday, Polish Minister of Foreign Affairs Radosław Sikorski was in Kiev discussing Ukraine's anti-drone procedures Poland would implement if the threat persists. There hasn't been a formal assessment of whether the incursion of Gerbera drones and decoys was deliberate, But the intelligence services of NATO countries conferred to discuss their findings related to the incident and concluded that it most likely was a deliberate attack, according to people familiar with the discussions. Russia has sought to deflect blame, saying its drones didn't have the capability to travel as far as the border into Poland, let alone deep into the country. Some military analysis suggests the unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, were modified for longer flights. This past weekend brought a fresh wave of warnings in Poland, when more Russian drone strikes in neighboring Ukraine forced Warsaw again to send jets and close its Lublin airport on Poland's eastern flank. This time, no drones crossed the border, but the alerts rattled fragile nerves. On Saturday afternoon, Ichtia and Tomasz Wysorek, a couple in the eastern Polish village of Kursowo-Wierzbicia, were having coffee when their phones lighted up with a new government emergency service alert. Fearing another round of violence, they also were exasperated by the government's failure to tell them how to respond. Just then, reports that a drone had violated Romania's airspace came through on their phone screens. NATO jet fighters tracked the drone but didn't shoot it down, according to Romania's defense ministry, who said the UAV was a Shahed used by Russia in Ukraine. Ejikata Wiskorek, 43, said she wants the government to organize drone drills for residents, since the drone smashed through the Wieselski's home. In the neighboring village, her 12-year-old daughter has refused to sleep in her second-floor bedroom, she said. None of us knows what to do in case of a mass drone attack. More importantly, we do not have any shelters around here. Many residents nearby are awaiting word from the state about what happened last week and what they can expect. In absence of explanation, the villagers are assembling their own timeline and asking whether NATO's response might have caused more damage than it prevented. The cost of the response is also under review, a scrutiny. Christian Ziek, one of the creators of the system for integrating F-16 jet fighters within the Polish Armed Forces, said that the operation to take down the drones likely cost about $8 billion. Days after the incursions, President Karol Nawrocki approved the deployment of NATO forces in Poland, but it is still unclear how and when that would happen. And Israel seeks an unlivable Gaza. Qatar's ruling emir, hosting a summit of Arab and Islamic nations discussing a response to Israel's attack on Hamas leaders in his capital, Doha, last week opened the session by accusing Israel of not caring about its hostage in Gaza and instead working to ensure Gaza is no longer livable. Israel has said its war goals include bringing back the hostages and defeating Hamas. Those who work consistently to assassinate the party in these negotiations will certainly do everything to ensure the failure of these negotiations, said Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. The speech was unusually fiery for the 45-year-old ruler whose country has served as mediator in ceasefire talks. Excuse me. And the king has rolled out the red carpet. Britain leans on its monarchy to keep Trump administration sweet on the UK. London this week, the British government will play its royal Trump card. King Charles III, Prince William and more than 1,500 soldiers will welcome President Trump to Windsor Castle on Wednesday in an effort to butter up the U.S. president and cement a diplomatic relationship with the most Anglophile U.S. leader in decades. Over 2 days, the grounds around the 1,000-year-old castle will be turned into a regal theme park, where Trump and his First Lady will travel in a horse-drawn carriage to the sound of military bands, witness firing cannons, and flyover, and be the guests of honor at a lavish banquet. In doing so, Trump will be the first U.S. president to have had two such state visits organized in his honor, after a previous visit to Buckingham Palace in 2019. Trump gushed about his trip in remarks to reporters on Sunday, pointing out that he was making royal history. It's going to be very exciting. For the British government, which decides who gets such state visits, much is at stake. The UK has so far leveraged Trump's soft spot for Britain to try to navigate his global trade war, securing an early tariffs deal that is lower than the levies outlined for most other countries. Prime Minister Keir Starmer is hoping that a renewed dose of pomp and ceremony will soften Trump up for more discussions around steel tariffs and efforts to bolster U.S. support for European security when the two men hold a bilateral meeting on Thursday. Starmer is using the UK's monarchy as a diplomatic arsenal very effectively, and that may have helped him avoid the worst. Social media tirades or harsher tariffs in the trade wars, said Lewis Lukens, a former career U.S. ambassador who served as a senior U.S. embassy official in London in Trump's first term. The visit by Trump will be timed with announcements of greater U.S. and U.K. cooperation in tech, financial services, AI, and nuclear energy. But Britain officials conceded nothing is assured with Trump. Potential flashpoints include the UK's government's decision to potentially recognise Palestinian statehood and the recent removal of its Washington ambassador over his past friendship with disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein. US officials said the state visit wouldn't only highlight the special relationship between the two countries, but also celebrate a slightly more delicate issue for the royal family. The coming 250th anniversary of America's founding, when the country ditched the British monarchy for its independence. During the past century, the British monarchy has completed a foreign policy transition from rulers of a vast empire to celebratory diplomats. Regal soft power is becoming an increasingly important crutch for Britain. The special relationship between the UK and the US is particular, has become even more lopsided, so much so that the prospects of an overnight stay with a real king is a key linchpin in keeping the leader of the free world satisfied. Trump often has spoken of his regard for the late Queen Elizabeth II, whom his Scottish mother much admired. He also has a fondness for Charles, whom he made an honorary member of his Mar-a-Lago club in 1990s. Starmer's government wasted no time wooing Trump. A good relationship wasn't a sure thing, given many voices in Trump's MAGA movement have been sharply critical of the UK over issues like immigration and free speech, and given Starmer leads a left-of-centre Labour government. When Starmer visited with Trump in February, one of his first actions was to hand over a signed note from Charles, inviting him to a state visit, to which Trump said, "Oh, wow." Seasoned British royal watchers weren't impressed by the stunt. as personal invitations from the king aren't normally waved in front of the masses. It was like seeing someone with their trousers down. Robert Hardman, a royal biographer, quoted one royal official in his book, Charles III. The novelty factor holding the visit at Windsor as Buckingham Palace is being refurbished is another lure for Trump. Trump and his wife will visit Queen Elizabeth's tomb and meet with Prince William and Catherine, Princess of Wales. Finally, polls show Trump isn't popular with the British people, which makes King Charles' lavishing attention on the US president look out of step with his subjects' views. Any crowds will be kept well away from Windsor Garden. The Windsor grounds, yeah. The U.S. military attacked a second vessel in international waters on Monday that was allegedly transporting illegal narcotics to the U.S., killing three people. President Trump announced the strike in a post on Truth Social, along with an unclassified video that showed the vessel blowing up in a fireball. The three people killed were from Venezuela, Trump said. The attack took place in U.S. Southern Command's area of operation, which includes Central and South America as well as the Caribbean. It was the second military action this month against a vessel in international waters that Trump has ordered, claiming that they were carrying illegal narcotics that pose a threat to U.S. national security. The attacks have spurred a debate about Trump's legal authority to use force against civilian drug traffickers. Venezuelan officials didn't comment. Pentagon officials haven't spoken publicly about the strike. Trump said on Monday that General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had shown him evidence that the men killed on board had been trafficking drugs. All you have to do is look at the cargo that was splattered all over the ocean, Trump told reporters in an Oval Office.